I've been wanting to do a panel session on Indigenous tourism for a long time, and finally it's turned out to be possible to do it. Mark Watson, who was previously with Tourism Concern, asked a question in the last session. He's going to start by giving a kind of framework discussion about Indigenous tourism, why it's a good thing, but also what some of the problems are with it. And then we've got two examples from different places in North America. So, Mark, over to you. There will be time for questions at the end of this, I promise. Mark, okay, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Howard. As Howard said, I was the Executive Director at Tourism Concern for about 7 years. We campaigned for ethical and fair trade tourism, lobbied the industry to adopt best practice, and helped tourists make better and more informed choices about their holidays. We wanted tourism to benefit local communities. So I'm very pleased to be here talking about Indigenous people in tourism. So, you know, Indigenous people, self-defined groups, ethnically and culturally distinct, quite often marginalised in their own country. There's about 370 million Indigenous people around the world, belonging to 5,000 different groups. As I said, they tend to be marginalised both geographically, politically, socially and economically within their countries. So Indigenous people and tourism, quite often Indigenous people become just a tourist attractions in their own right. Their opinions are quite often not sought when tourism is being developed, particularly on their lands. I think minority rights groups say about 12 million Indigenous people have been displaced from their land to make way for tourist development. Tribal villages become just showcases for tourists, and their cultures are commodified, artifacts, etc., just become tourist attractions. So Indigenous tourism is different in different places. Obviously, there's a whole range of different Indigenous communities out there. The Jarawa were in the news about 5 years ago. The Jarawa are meant to be completely isolated. They don't want contact with the outside world. They're in a protected reserve. But in this case here, the police were taking bribes off of tourists to take tourists to see the Jarawa, throwing them food so they the tourists would come, so they have a tourist photograph, etc. Obviously a huge impact on the communities. These are isolated communities, so contact with people from outside their community can bring disease, etc. It was against the law, but tourists wanting that experience would bribe the police to do that. Similar thing in the Machu Picchu in Peru. Again, there's tour operators there that will run literally human safaris to go and see these people. There was a case, again, about 4 or 5 years ago when a tourist chasing these people down the riverbank to get a good photograph, and they turned around and threw a spear at him, and I think they killed him while he was there. So it's not only dangerous for the communities themselves, but for tourists. But these people don't want to have contact with tourists. Tourists are imposing themselves on these communities without any thought. In other examples, you might say the Kayan in northern Thailand or the Mersey, very different experience. These are very isolated communities, very economically disadvantaged communities. They rely very much on tourism to bring an income, but the tourism is very, becomes, again, you know, human safaris, people going and here's the long-necked women, only taking the tourists on take photographs of the girls with the long necks, the brass rings in their neck. The Mersey, the women here, their culture has become very much commodified. They get money from tourists by putting the lip plates in. The tourists will only pay if people put the lip plates in, and obviously the bigger the lip plate, more the money they will get. So this is a tradition that was probably dying out culturally, but now has become a tourist attraction. So Indigenous communities are end up sort of perpetrating these rituals which have nothing to do with them. And if you talk to the Mersey, it's quite interesting. They've got what they call the tourist song. Essentially, it's a made-up song, and they just make up stuff and put stuff on their head. The more exotic, the better, because the tourist will pay for that. It means absolutely nothing. It has no cultural relevance at all. So that is not a great form of tourism. And there's a very good film, Framing the Other, and it just shows you how, you know, what a disappointment it is, both for the Mersey when they engage with tourists and for the tourists engaging with the Mersey, because it's not done in a very equitable way. And we always talk about free, prior and informed consent. But you remember these communities are very, very poor, so they don't have the same choices as many other people. So, you know, when we're talking about free consent, prior consent, you have to understand that when people have got very few options, it's very difficult for them to be able to do that. Maasai in Kenya and Tanzania, you know, quite often you will see here probably tourism being advertised using the Maasai as a way of making as a tourist promotion, and yet the Maasai have been displaced from their lands in both Kenya and Tanzania. In Kenya, I think about 70% of tourist resorts are on the lands of Maasai people, who quite often no longer have access to those lands because of the tourist developments, so displacement. The Sami and the Xtal actually are much better examples, where the local community, the indigenous people themselves, are more in control of the tourism that's happening and are being able to develop that in a way that actually does bring not only economic benefits but social benefits, and actually is a way of sharing their culture. So there are good examples of indigenous tourism, but there's lots of examples where indigenous tourism has had very negative effects on those communities. So indigenous image quite often gets used, quite often it's the only thing indigenous people have is the image. So, you know, in the Western country we have a whole range of cultural ways of presenting ourselves. Indigenous communities are obviously, broken down to a very simple status. Very romanticised images of indigenous people. And people want to go there because they want to see this, the indigenous communities. I was at the Guarani in Brazil, and they have controlled tourism there, but they've only been tourists once a month. But of course, they say the biggest complaint they get from tourists is tourists go there and they don't like the idea that some of them have got satellite TV or use mobile phones, etc., because it's ruined the experience for them, because they want to see them living in this very isolated world. And talking to the people there, it's quite interesting, because they want to keep their culture, but you talk to people there about what their hopes and dreams are for their children, and they want their children to be doctors and nurses and lawyers, etc., and not actually be spend time in the village itself. So how do you keep your culture while trying to modernise as well? Sacred sites are often used, misappropriated, so you have the issue with Ayers Rock, Table Mountain, etc. And if you think of these places, these are very spiritual places for indigenous communities, in the same way as cathedrals or mosques are spiritual places for us. So having people clamber all over these areas is very disrespectful to them. Ceremonies become very easily abused. People wanting to go there have experiences in sweat boxes or drinking, eating frogs or whatever, licking frogs in South America. So where does the visitor's presence intrude upon the culture? Land rights are a huge issue. Many tourism developments displace people, so you have the Bushmen in the Kalahari and Botswana being denied access to water and their traditional roles because of tourist development. There are some good regulatory bodies, and there have been indigenous communities that have been coming together. Certainly Aboriginal tourism is beginning to organise and be able to make sure the stakeholders themselves have a say in the tourism development. The Sami have been very successful in doing that. And there is the World Indigenous Tourism Alliance. But it's very difficult. All of these are very marginalised communities in their own country, so have very little say over the type of tourism that happens to them or whether tourism happens at all. So when we've made recommendations, we did a report. It's still available on the Tourism Concern website. So, you know, we should, you know, tour operators and the company need to take note of the sacred knowledge systems in place with indigenous communities, engage in collective decision making so people understand what tourism will mean, how they can control that tourism, what it will mean for their communities, and let them be in charge of the type of tourism that takes place. Make sure that their communities and customary law and the protocols are represented. I think really is to make sure that it comes simply down to making sure indigenous people have a say in the tourism that is taking part and they are engaged in that process. Thank you.
Good job.
So we're going to go now to the USA. We don't very often have a speaker from the USA on our panels, so it's a real pleasure.
Why, thank you. I am honored to be here. Banachish anyat kosani. Ayahat devosak sistankla ayahat. What I said was, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Siestan Kla, is my Tlingit name. I'm from Sitka, Alaska, born and raised, native from the Alaska area. I'm fortunate that I've actually had the opportunity to work for the tribe, developing their cultural tourism programs for the tribe in Sitka and then throughout Alaska. And then just 5 years ago, I advanced my career to work with the American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association. And so what I'd like to do is let you know a little bit about who Ianta is. Like he said, he doesn't really have very many people from America come here and speak. The American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association is an nonprofit organization introducing Native America to the world. That is what we do. What we have to keep in mind when what we've been doing is we keep our mission. Our mission is to define, introduce, grow, and sustain, and I like the idea that I'm talking about sustainability, American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian tourism that honors traditions and values. So anytime I go astray, that mission brings us back. We are dedicated to developing Indian tourism industry across Indian country. What Ianta does, and this is real important, is we sustainability. You look at sustainability for Indian country tourism or Native America or Native Hawaiian tourism. The sustainability comes from the training, and it's not just technical assistance and the technical assistance in training, marketing, teaching how to market Indian country tourism, form these partnerships, and become the national voice. That's only what our association does. We actually encourage the fact that the only way we're going to be able to sustain tourism is through our youth. And it takes our elders to bring that together for sustainability. Without those two, there will not be cultural tourism. So we're very well aware of that. But what Ianta does do is we do provide the technical assistance and training for developing tourism. That is really important because we want all tribes that are entering into tourism to take control. And I really respect the fact that he had mentioned that. I think it's really important that all tribes take control of tourism and don't let tourism take control of you. Ianta promotes the fact that we're telling our own story. We, as you can see, there's the United States, and we represent each one region within the United States because there are tribes throughout the whole United States. There are 573 federally recognized tribes. And when I first came here, people were real surprised to find out that Native America is, the tribes are still there. The history books don't say the end of the story. They only tell you part of a story. Well, we're here to introduce you to Native America because, as you will see by this map here, Indian country, Native American Native America goes clear across the country. There are, in the state of Alaska, there are 222 tribes themselves right within the state of Alaska. And what we have done is we come to shows like this so that we can introduce you to the many different tribes and share with you the many different cultures that are within the tribe. Culture is a way of life, and throughout the United States, there are many tribes still living a way of life that they want to share. Now, the trends for Native American tourism has definitely grown. Since we've been introducing tourism in the international market since 2009, we've grown 180%. That means people like you, like everyone, want to experience an authentic experience. They want to meet the Native Americans. And that is shown through the visitors that have come to the United States that had visited Native American communities. So I wanted to kind of share that with you because it's important to know that that there is a economic reason why tribes are getting involved in tourism. But the real reason why tribes are getting involved in it, because it's a way to perpetuate our culture, not preserve it, but to perpetuate it, to keep it alive. A lot of our tribal elders are now teaching our youth and sharing that youth on. And so now our youth are sharing it with visitors. What that means for Indian country is the pride that we get. You know, we have been suppressed. Native Americans have been suppressed for many years, taken from our homes, put into boarding schools, told that you are not to be a native. Well, the pendulum has changed. We are proud of who we are. We're able to be able to tell our stories, and we encourage that. And tourism is a venue in which we are able to do it. And it's not just economic, it's a social benefit. And there are a number of tribes that are doing so. We encourage, like I mentioned before, we encourage telling our stories. Native America is full of untold stories. How many of you have heard of the Civil War? Raise your hand. How many of you heard of the American Indians in the Civil War? How many of you knew that they were very instrumental? Well, we have a book now that tells our story. How many of you know about Route 66 from Santa Monica to Chicago? How many of you know about a Green Book? It was a book that was used to help people of color travel along that route so that they would have a safe place to stay at a hotel or go to a store. The Native Americans have a story as well. And so we're telling that story. So we have the book, The American Indians and the Route 66 Guidebook, so you can learn about the natives along that route. Grand Canyon. Everybody knows that world wonder. Did you know that there are 11 tribes still living within that area? We brought a sense of place back to the desert view. And we used tourism to help do it. The tribes have come there, repurposed that area, and now are part of telling that story of the Grand Canyon. As you can tell, that is real important because we are not a bygone people. We're here. We're still here, and we want to share our history with you, but we want to tell our story. And so tourism is a way in which we're doing it. How we are reaching, the question is how are we reaching people? We have the NativeAmerica.travel website. It's the portal to Indian country. Every tribe, 573 tribes, are given a page to call their own. So they're telling their stories. They're putting up their images. We're not doing it for them. We just provided a venue for them to do that. And so tribes that don't want tourism, they need to have that page too, because they need to say, this is our history, this is who we are, but we're not ready for you. And take ownership of that. Control who is coming in. So if you get a chance, get on that website and explore Indian country through the portal. It's just beginning. We've got a lot of tribes to populate it. We also do these international shows. And we do these international shows to actually introduce Indian country to the world, but not only that, train tribes how to work with the international market and how to network with other indigenous peoples across the world. I know that there's going to be lots of questions, and I knew I had to keep this semi-brief, but I want to say to all of you, Gonachish, thank you for giving me this opportunity to let you know that we're still here.
Camille, just before you... Camille, just before you leave this, we're going to come back to Q&A, but I'm taking the opportunity. You talked about the importance of the international visitors.
Right.
What proportion of the visitors who come to meet the tribes are actually international as opposed to...
The interesting thing is that the data collection for the domestic traveler to Native American communities has not been measured. The international has been measured through our Department of Commerce. However, we have been doing some research within ourselves to see what is going on. But when we're at trade shows, one of our largest visitors are the local state DMOs who want to know what's going on in Native America in our own state. So that data is not collected. We have, I guess we don't have that data, but the domestic traveler is, I wish I could give you a number. We're just now getting data, starting to collect that data. That's how new in the industry Indian Country tourism is. Is there, even Brand USA doesn't have that data.
Thanks very much indeed. Thank
you.
I didn't realise. Thank you. So, the final presentation of this year's Responsible Tourism Programme goes to a gentleman who lives on Orkney, which is an offshore island off Scotland, with a strong indigenous culture. But he's going to be talking about some of the work you do with Native American tribes. Native North American tribes.
Thank you, Harold. And thank you all very much for the opportunity to talk to you. I'm in the enviable position of going third. That means, of course, all I have to do is to echo all of the very good points that the two previous speakers made. I would like to talk about three things. I would like to reflect on some work that we've been doing in Nunavut, and I'll say some more about Nunavut in a moment. So I'll talk about Nunavut, the territory. Then I'll talk about work that we've been doing with one individual community in Nunavut, so we'll shift the focus down. And then thirdly, I'd like to share some reflections on what we believe we've learned from that experience. And I hope those learnings are as relevant to your own work. So that's our agenda. Those are the three things. So let's talk about Nunavut, and I ought to acknowledge this photograph, which I used from Destination Nunavut's website. I recommend the website if you want a visual insight into what the territory is all about. Nunavut is northern Canada. It's part of Canada's Arctic, and the Arctic is very much a topic of interest at the moment because it's gradually disappearing in part. So it's northern Canada, and it was created into a territory in 1999. So as a self-governing territory, it's fairly new, but people have lived there for thousands of years, and they lived traditional lives. And I said lived quite deliberately because the reality is they still live there. We say traditional, we always think it's heritage, it's in the past. And to echo the point that you made, it's a living culture. People live, love, hunt, live and die there. It's a living culture. Because of the nature of the territory, access is by air. The ice melts a couple of times a year and freighters can come in. But most visitor access is by air. There are no roads. There are no railroads. And it's fairly sparsely populated as a territory. It's about 37,000 people, 37,000 people, in a landmass slightly bigger than Mexico. Okay, so that's a huge, huge area. And it means that the scatter of hamlets in that landscape are in effect islands. Access is difficult, communication is difficult, population sizes are small. But Nunavut is all about land and people. We talk a lot about sustainability. It's on everybody's lips and the environment. And we often talk about it as something external. but an Inuit culture, landscape, land and people, and the wildlife that inhabit that landscape are all one and the same thing. Culture is everything. The environment isn't external, it's internal. So that's land and people. And let's talk just a little bit about tourism in Nunavut. Business travel dominates. Government, health workers, contractors. That's the dominant type of tourism at the moment. There's growing numbers of cruise passengers because of an interest in the Arctic. Expedition ships are beginning to visit communities. And there's a small number of leisure tourists and VFR, visiting friends and relatives. And in terms of tourism development, you can characterise it very much as an emerging destination. Tourism is new. Tourism is fairly low-key and small-scale. At almost $38 million Canadian dollars in 2015. And it's all about indigenous culture and heritage. 85% of the population are Inuit. So when we talk about indigenous tourism, it's almost all indigenous tourism by default. And people come because of indigenous culture and heritage, and they come because of the national and territorial parks. It is one of the most stunningly beautiful places in the world. And I hope there's somebody here from Destination Nunavut who can nod as it is one of the most stunningly beautiful places in the world. It is staggering. And the national and territorial parks are very much part of that appeal. And there's a whole series of treaty arrangements between Indigenous people and the government about how to manage aspects of that environment. And there is one of these treaties, an IIBA, Inuit Impact Benefit Agreement, in respect of communities with territorial parks. And I want to talk for a moment about the work that we've been doing in Nunavut in respect of those communities with territorial parks. And the territorial approach that we've adopted, the treaty arrangement covers the whole province. And we were asked to get involved to help develop a community-based sustainable tourism model. Community-based sustainable tourism, that's where the industry is now. That is a good thing. Delighted to be involved in doing that. The process we went through is we took our own experience in community-based sustainable tourism in other jurisdictions and the wider industry, and created what I've called here a blended model. And that, what I mean by that is the model blends good practice in community-based sustainable tourism and blends that with Inuit indigenous societal values, IQ it's known as for short, that takes those traditional values, traditional beliefs, and we built those into the model for sustainable tourism development. Because to echo a point that was made earlier, community-based sustainable tourism needs to be owned by the community that is developing that tourism. And we also built into that blended model the provisions of the treaty, the things that the government and the Inuit communities had agreed must be done. You must create job opportunities. You must sustain communities. So out of that came a framework, which is illustrated here, a community-based sustainable tourism framework, which isn't consultants from the wider global travel industry coming to indigenous communities saying, this is the way it should be, this is it. This is the blueprint for the future. This is a model that captures the very best of traditional values, traditional beliefs. It captures the role of elders in leading communities, and it captures the sort of welcome that a whole community can give to guests who visit their community. So we created that model, and we created as well a step-by-step implementation workbook, a how to implement community-based sustainable tourism, step by careful step, involving community members so that the community owns the tourism that's developed in their community. And if they don't want to develop tourism, that's their decision as a community. But the framework is intended to enable them to do so if they wish. So that's what's happening at the territorial level. Government-supported, community-led development of sustainable tourism. At an individual local level, let me introduce you to a place which I think, if anywhere in Nunavut, is my favourite, the most beautiful place in the most beautiful region in the world. It's the community of Kikitadjuwak, known as Kik for short, which is a stunningly beautiful place. It's on Broughton Island, which is off Baffin Island. And if you go east from there, very soon you're in Greenland. So it's in that sort of neck of the woods. It's an Arctic community of about 600 people. It has an airport, it has a small hotel, and it has a gathering centre. And the gathering centre has a role as a visitor centre, as a base for tourism activity in the region, as the offices of Parks Canada, so responsible for the environment, and it's also a meeting place for the elders. So as visitors visit the community, on a day-to-day basis, they're going to encounter the elders in the community because they're guests in the community. And Kik is also at the north end of Aiwitik National Park. If any of you have watched a Bond movie in which James Bond skis down a mountainside in the snow, all very beautiful, all very dramatic, that's the Aiwitik National Park. So in terms of tourism product, it's activity tourism, it's wildlife watching, it's hiking, and so on. And the approach we took in Kikitadjuwak, and I told you it's beautiful, you need to enjoy snow and cold, but it is stunning. And that's the gathering centre there. It was an award-winning building. The approach we took there was all about community engagement, about being completely open to community members for them to say how they want to develop tourism, because it's not for me to go into any community and say, here's what you must do. There is a role for people like me in helping communities take the small practical steps that create tourism, step by careful step. One of the first things that the community leader said to us when we arrived was, Cameron, do reassure me, this isn't just another bullshit strategy, is it? And that about sums up the approach. No, it's not just another bullshit strategy. It's a step-by-step approach to developing tourism, working with people who want to get involved. As an example of these small steps, here's a practical example. If you think about some of the fundamental building blocks of tourism, it is a guided walk. It is a visit to somebody's home. And a visit to somebody's home is one of the most intimate, one of the most natural, one of the most sustainable, community-friendly tourism products in the world. It's easy to do. You don't need to be an expert to have somebody around to your home for tea. But that enriches the community member's life, and it's a unique experience for a visitor. So a whole series of small practical steps, not one bullshit strategy in it. If you want an insight into what Kik is all about from a tourism perspective, have a look at kik.travel, which is a community tourism website. Another aspect of the approach was community ownership. I think Indigenous entrepreneurship is a good thing and to be encouraged. Community involvement in tourism is also a good thing and to be encouraged. And a community, if you think about a community, Hamlet of Kikitadjuwak, they've got an existing community infrastructure which is able to take money, able to do things, able to plan, able to react, able to deal with contingencies. So if it's the community itself which is the tourism provider and it's in effect subcontracting to local guides to do things, that avoids problems of local guides being delayed out hunting, out doing something else. and it places the community right at the centre of tourism. And there are three principal markets that the community of Qikiqtarjuaq is tapping into. The first is the business tourism market. There are contractors and government workers arriving in the community who, if you ask them, would love to go on a guided walk, would love to go on a skidoo out to the icebergs, would like to learn a bit of Inuktitut, would like to learn the local language, but nobody has asked them. They're already in the community. They don't need to pay to go there, so the cost of travel and the cost of travel into the north of Canada is hideous. But they're already there. So that's a market to sell practical, sensible, small-scale tourism products to and bring some extra money into the community. Cruise passengers, there's an opportunity to engage with them, to get them to stay longer, to buy more local crafts, and to understand the community better. And there's adventure tourism. And we've been looking at the potential for a luxury adventure tourism base camp in Qikiqtarjuaq, taking advantage of the Iwetik National Park. There are five lessons that I want to share with you. The first is authenticity. It's a word that I think all three of us have used. Authenticity is absolutely fundamental to this. We're not, with all due respect to our American cousins, we're not creating Disney World. This is a real, living, breathing, indigenous culture with a fascinating set of values and a uniquely authentic tourism experience. The home visit product that I mentioned, the home visit that I went on as a pilot when we introduced it, the chap that I had tea with, Jay Pooty, had just been out hunting. And what he had been hunting was on the kitchen floor. And my first reaction was, wowza, do you actually want to show visitors that sort of thing? And Jay Pooty's view, and I couldn't agree with him more, is that is our life. If you want to understand our culture and our way of life, this is it. So authenticity. The second lesson to share with you is the importance of indigenous values. Sustainable tourism is great, it's a fabulous thing, it's all theory. Indigenous values need to be part of that, because indigenous values are alive and well, and they're what the community is all about. Third lesson is the importance of the interface between the community and the tourism industry. This industry that we're part of is a huge juggernaut. It consumes communities, unless it's managed effectively. And we shouldn't expect indigenous communities to all of a sudden, overnight, understand what we're all talking about and fall into line with the way that the industry works. There's a degree of translation, there's a degree of learning, there's a degree of maturity on both parts, and that interface is absolutely critical. The fourth lesson is that it takes a whole community to grow a tourist. A visitor's experience of an Arctic community such as Qikiqtarjuaq is an experience of the whole community. One of the most enriching things that I've done in that community is go to bingo night. We were invited to go to bingo night with the community. Absolutely fabulous. Because you're talking to the whole community. You're talking to people as people, simply as we do, as human beings. And the fifth lesson to share with you and to leave with you is, if you're ever travelling in the north and a community leader approaches you at the airport and says, I know you're going to the next door hamlet. If you're approached by a community leader at the airport who asks you to do them a favour and they say, could you take a couple of Arctic char to a neighbouring community to be consumed at a church social, always say yes, because it is the most interesting piece of hand baggage that you'll ever take in your entire life is a frozen fish. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Cameron. Now, in theory, we're supposed to finish at 4 o'clock, but we're not going to. We're going to go on for as long as you want to go on, and as long as we have people here who want to engage with you. I think that's been a fantastic session. Camille, you and I have talked about doing this for a long time. I can only apologise that it's taken so long to do it, but I think we're going to do something again next year on this, because it's clearly important. But the floor is yours now. It's open for questions. Is there anybody with a question?
Hi, I'm Anna Richman from the University of Bedfordshire. I'm actually doing PhD research on Indigenous people in Sri Lanka. And one of the things I'm looking at is really about the cost involved of setting up tourism and when, you know, where the money's coming from for some of them. You know, are they having to relinquish control in some way to bigger companies? Or are they, you know, like within Alaska, where's the funding coming from? Do they have certain goals or certain things they've got to meet to in order to qualify for the funding, or how does it work?
Who wants to go first?
It's a really good timing you asked that. The federal government never did provide any sort of tourism development for tribes. Tribes use their economic development, their compact funds, to do that. Just recently, there was a bill that actually that was passed through legislation that mandated federal agencies to work with Native American tribes. And then with that mandate, there was appropriations. And so just this year, there is going to be funding available for tribes for developing tourism. So a lot of that struggle that we've gone through historically, it was their tribes' resources. And so it was very limited.
Can I just push you on that? Because in my experience, funding always comes with strings. And you've been able to develop the way you've developed it because it's not been externally funded. Is that actually a threat to what you've done?
Well, actually, because we had control of how the language was going to be written in the bill, the Native American Tourism Improving Visitors Experience Act, because we had part of how it was written, we had a little more control of how we'll be working with the federal. Actually, we'll be watching the federal government versus the other way around.
Okay. Cameron, do you want to discuss that in relation to the work you've been doing? I mean, let me not be rude about this, but when you and I first met, I was amazed that a man from Orkney was working with that community. How did that happen?
It happened because we're an international tourism consultancy with a particular interest in community tourism. One of my business partners used to be on the board of Nunavut Tourism. Orkney as a community has got a hundreds and hundreds year old link with Northern Canada, so it's a very good empathetic fit, and we bring some knowledge and perspective from elsewhere to it. In terms of the funding for tourism development in Nunavut, the government's been very generous with the funding that it provides. I think it gets better value from funding tourism development at a community level than by taking a risk and funding individual businesses who may not be at the point in their development as a business where you get the best value for money from it. But there's a real commitment to develop tourism in Nunavut.
But for the control to remain with the community.
Yeah.
Mark, are you reassured by some of what you've heard, or are you...
Yeah, look, I think it's... There are good examples where Indigenous communities have come together and worked to produce an experience that they're in control of. I think for most Indigenous communities that is not happening. I mean, you take the Mersey, particularly in Ethiopia, they're very marginalised. The tour operators, it's an expensive business to go there. The tour operators will take most of that money that's spent. The men at the village take a cut of that coming in. The men actually then spend that getting drunk most of the time. Women, then the only money they get is by mutilating their lips so they take these for the take the money from the photographer, from the tourist photographers. So it's a very dispiriting experience. It's actually damaged the community there, and it's not a good experience either for the tourist or for the indigenous community. And I'm afraid a lot of indigenous community, indigenous tourism, is done to indigenous people rather than with indigenous people engagement. So it is good to see some of these examples happening, but it does need, they do need support, they need to be managed well, and the communities themselves have got to be at the heart of wanting that tourism to take place.
Camille, I guess the, thanks Mark, Camille, I guess the kind of hard question for you, and you did say you'd enjoyed the last session.
Yeah, I did.
But absolutely, so I'm going to ask you a hard question. Do you think that your community is politically strong enough to keep control of its own development?
Well, my community in Sitka, you know, where I'm from, the Sitka tribe is a very powerful tribe. And it took on tourism because it did not want the other companies telling our story. And so the tribe allowed me to, one, work with my elders to make it right, to make everything I do correct. And it was very political.
And are they defining correct?
What I mean defining correct, that means it was approved by my elders.
Right.
What I said, what stories I could tell, what dances we can do, what we were going to share, and how we were going to teach it, and what we were going to do to make sure that we maintained the authenticity and the integrity. And what I mean by that is traditionally we don't dance if someone had passed away. When you sign a contract with a cruise line, and an international cruise line, you have to do what you say you're going to do. Our elders created a balance for us by doing storytelling at that time, and we wrote that in the contract. So that balance was there. And when we told that story of why we were not dancing, everyone was going, they were just really happy that we were not willing to sacrifice our integrity for the dollar, for the tourist. And then that's how we kind of took control of that.
So it is, the political strength is with the community.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron,
yes.
Is that the case where you are as well, up in with the Nunavut?
I think it's essential for community-based sustainable tourism to succeed in practice for the community to own that. It's got some really strong supporters in the government of Nunavut, Destination Nunavut, and I think it's essential. Otherwise, communities are steamrolled by this huge edifice that's represented here at World Travel Market.
It's probably on.
Hello?
Yeah.
I'm Charlotte from Travel Rebel. I'm based in Belgium. I'm a digital influencer myself, but I was wondering if you would think about raising more awareness on these topics in a sustainable way, by working together with digital influencers and blogging that tell the story directly together with you and have a focus and are specialized in ethical tourism and sustainable tourism. So do you plan to work in the future with digital influencers?
I spend a lot of time trying to get people to take up stories on ethical tourism for a number of years. The people that are working on promoting ethical tourism are very small and the industry is very large, and trying to get our message across has always been a challenge, I think. And the problem is the tourism industry is big, it's globalized, it's not much control across it. The local governments are not interested in individual rights. I mean, you know, talk about indigenous tourism. You know, the Kayon in northern Thailand are refugees. They're undocumented. They haven't been helped by the government there. But the government is quite happy for tourists to come there and take photographs of them. The same as, you know, the Maasai, the Mersey, etc. The same thing happens. So, yes, I mean, anything we can do to raise awareness of these issues. I mean, part of tourism concerns remit was really to raise awareness with tourists and, you know, on the grounds that most tourists don't set out to trash the world or to be difficult or to be culturally inappropriate. Most people are decent people, end up doing these things, not understanding the issues. So more we can do to raise awareness of the issues, I think tourists will make better decisions if they understand the consequences or the impacts of what they're doing. But
so, Mark, if most people are decent people, why does it go wrong?
Why does it go wrong? I don't know. You know, it is interesting. I think people quite often are not aware of their impacts. I think we have a situation where we've commodified travel. People expect to go there and not think about giving back. Where, you know, we ran a campaign is that your holiday is their homes, and I think if you think of travelling as a way of experiencing other people's communities and lives, you treat it as visiting a friend for dinner. You wouldn't go there, you'd take a bottle of wine, you'd give something back, and you wouldn't trash their house and steal all their food when you left. And yet a lot of tourists seem to think it's perfectly okay to places and do that. And I think part of that codification of tourism has happened, and the industry has been, you know, pushing that because it's profitable. I do think people become more aware of their impacts. People will change their behaviours, but I think that the inherent model we have in tourism is quite difficult to change.
So thanks so much. It was really, really interesting panel. My name's Dana. I work for a French company called Avanos. We work with hundreds of thousands of travelers to send them to 160 destinations. And we know that these travelers are looking for these types of authentic experiences. We know that more and more travelers are, you know, doing conscious consumerism and voting with their wallets. And so, you know, when we talk to the thousands of tour agencies in all of these destinations that package these experiences for us, we tell them, you know, our customers, if you can provide these kind of community supported tourism experiences, our customers are asking for them. And then the local agencies that we're working with in these destinations, they come back and they tell me, oh yes, I found a very nice village. There's a very nice woman there that can make a great homestay. And this makes me so nervous, you know, because that innovation, that packaging has happened in the span of a week. And it's like, we know this is a very long process. So what can a traditional travel company, a large one, do when we're working with our supply chain, our DMCs and our subcontractors to make sure that when they are suggesting these types of community immersive experiences, that they are the right experiences? What questions do I need to ask?
Come on, one of you. Camille first and then Cameron maybe.
One of the things that we do, you know, and we have our struggles too in rural parts of the United States as well. And one of the problems that we have is infrastructure to get you out there. So one of the things that is really that we have to do as a DMO, and I call myself a destination marketing organization for all of Indian Native America. And so one of the things that we teach is product ready. And so that's the question that you may want to ask. Is your tribe product ready? Do they know that there are certain criteria that have to be kind of in place? Safety is always a good thing to ask. And so making sure, because indigenous communities are getting involved. And we work with George Washington University and actually wrote a guidebook on how tribes should work with tour operators and how tour operators should respect the tribes that they're visiting. And we're trying to get that out. And it's free. Any of you want it? Let's get it out there, because it really does. It's a guidebook on how to work with tribal communities and how tribes work with tour operators.
Yeah, and the model as the community-based sustainable tourism model that we developed for Nunavut has got embedded within it that same concept of product ready and an assessment of each product within a community, at what stage on that journey is it? And the workbook we've developed asks the community to make that very explicit. So they're asking themselves questions about, really, can we deliver this if somebody asks for it? What does it look like? Who would do it? And then that becomes part of a document. It becomes, in effect, part of a promise to potential visitors. That's quite a journey to go down, because that sort of activity will take years to do. And in the meantime, I think it's building up trust through organisations like Destination Nunavut in that particular, who represent the whole territory, to talk to them about what advice they would give about the operator with the experience, with the track record, at the right stage in their development journey, and seek that sort of support. If we had the same discussion in 20 years' time, we'd be a lot more confident about there are 43 operators like this or this. But it's a journey.
Okay. I'm Elisa. I'm at the moment collaborating with Travindi, and I've been volunteering for Tourism Concern for a while. But my question is to Cameron mainly. I work with community-based tourism in Brazil, and when you came with that word, the interface between community and industry, it is really crucial. And I would like you to share, I invite you to share with us some tips or good experiences, because it is the problem. I mean, for Brazil, there are, because of the history, the community, of the abuse they experienced all along the way, they totally closed up. But they need the industry to, as the industry need them in a way. I mean, they had to find a way to talk to each other as a peer, but at the moment the community is not a peer to the industry. So talking about this interface, the critical point of it, can you share something, some good example tips with us? Thank you.
Can I just add to that question before you answer it? So it seems to me one of the things that distinguishes the two places that you're working is that there's still a great deal of independence and social and political capital and the ability to deploy that in the two communities that you're talking about. And I'm wondering to what extent this is possible with indigenous communities who've already lost all of those rights. We're talking here about two places which are still strong and where you're opening up to tourism. We're not talking about places where the indigenous rights are already lost and tourism is being asked to put them back. Have I got that right? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I can only answer the question from the perspective of Nunavut and the experience there. And you're right, Harold, it is where it is. It's strong communities where they are indigenous, they feel indigenous. In terms of tips for making that community-based sustainable tourism work, I think it's a lot to do with empathy. I think it's a lot to do with helping a community discuss together, meet together, learn from each other, learn from the experts that they bring in, and for them to make their own decisions and to have those decisions then supported and implemented. The most successful workshop that we ran in a series of workshops in Kikatajawak was one where we provided tea, we provided cakes, we provided cookies, and we invited people in to come and talk to us about tourism. Just what's your experience? We had a private agenda, but there was no formal agenda. All we wanted to do was get people to talk about their aspirations, their hopes. And we invited elders in the community, and we invited young people in the community. And everybody sat in an environment in which they were comfortable. It wasn't a being lectured at environment. It wasn't Cameron's workshop. It was the community workshop that we were guests at and we were facilitating. And that's a process that takes time and it takes trust. It took us two or three visits to reach that position of trust. It took doing what sound like really trivial things, but are actually quite important, which was going to Nunavut Day celebration in the community hall, where there were community games being played. And they asked us to join the game that the elders were playing. So we joined in with the elders in the community and just had fun together, engaged with them, but all of it with a tourism development subtext about, okay, what action are we going to take as a consequence of this? And we agreed the actions that were going to be taken, and we delivered on the promises that we'd made. We said, let's develop some small, simple tourism products together. So we did that. And it's those sorts of small, incremental, trust-building steps.
Camille, can I just sharpen the question a bit for you? You talked about the importance of tourism potentially helping to perpetuate your culture. You used that word extremely explicitly, and I suspect it had more meaning than most of us probably realised.
Right.
So you might just want to unpack that. And the other question I wanted to ask you is, you obviously work with a lot of different indigenous North American groups. Have you managed to use tourism to strengthen an already weak group? Or is the reality that we're talking about working sympathetically with strong groups which still have a strong sense of their identity?
Well, I do work with all the tribes. You know, from the Pacific Northwest to the Southwest tribes, the Pueblos, the Navajos, all of the native communities are in different levels of tourism. And some of them are just now looking at tourism as a viable option for, continuing on their culture. And I say perpetuation, and I actually purposely emphasize that. And that's because our Native people across the nation have been suppressed. Their history taken away. People telling our history. So when I say perpetuate, there's a lot of reasons why I'm saying that, because it was taken away, and there are a lot of tribes that are trying to rejuvenate their cultures because a lot of it was gone. And if you go to National Park Service or some of the museums, it almost seems like the Native people are a bygone people. They're black and white. They're not there. And so this, I think, is to perpetuate our culture, is to say that we're still here, we're living, and we want to continue to live. But every tribe is different, and every tribe is in a different level. Our tribe is probably two steps ahead of some of the other tribes. You can go in the Southwest where there are all the Pueblos, and some Pueblos have advanced tourism, and some don't even have any at all. So it just depends on what tribe you are coming to see. And that's the real important thing that we're trying to do, is to encourage tribes to take their story, whether it's good or bad, and tell it. And it may be that they had their cultures taken away, but how are they bringing it back is a story that people want to hear.
But Camille, do you have examples where tribes who have had their social structure and their culture damaged, do you have examples where tourism is helping to restore and renew that?
The Southeast tribes in Alaska, a lot of their, matter of fact, they took a whole community called Huna and made it a destination. And this is where they have all the elders that are actually sewing and actually making a thriving business of doing that. The Seminole tribe is an example of a tribe that is very, very successful financially, that have used their finances to supplement and bring back their language by utilizing their gaming, their economic development. So there are plenty of them out there.
Thank you very much. Andy Rutherford from Fresh Eyes, People to People Travel. Quite simply, this is the most important discussion. And I just want to thank the organizers for this last session on responsible tourism. And a couple of reflections. First of all, your two wonderful presentations have shared with us communities who are coherent, organized, and have articulated their voice and their wishes and their aspirations. And they have community-based structures to do that. You consulted with the elders, but also I'm sure for the many other levels, as you shared with us as well, Cameron. I'm very struck by your question, which is a very fair and important question for now. And it goes back to democracy. It goes back to community-based tourism on one side, but also the issues of participatory democracy and accountability within that. Now, that sounds all very obvious, but I think as Mark shared, the industry around us probably has a very, very significant democratic deficit in those sorts of discussions. So the answer to your question should be, you cannot have a DMC as a political intermediary agent. That is not democratic. If that is the situation, therefore you should answer yourself saying we cannot operate there, because it is the democratic deficit around decision making is so strong, and that is where responsibility comes in, and the commercial interests have to be second place, because at stake are cultures, our heritages, but also in general in the areas outside indigenous tourism, the body fabric of societies as a whole. And I think that is where the responsibility has to be taken on, not by the communities per se, but by the tourist industries or people wishing to interface. And they should have a very simple checklist to do with participation, democracy and accountability and transparency. And if those boxes are not ticked, back off, you know, and until they are.
That was a long question, but who has the answer?
Well, I'm not sure there is a. Well, we've tried to come up with answers previously, and I think it's just trying to get the industry to adopt that. But I think with indigenous tourism, where we're talking about, I think for most indigenous communities, I think what Harold was alluding to, because they are already marginalised, are struggling even to understand their own identity and how that they can keep their culture in a modern world and how they can develop. That tourism, even if it brings short-term benefits, is actually damaging to a lot of those cultures, because they're not ready and they're not supported enough to do that. The examples we've seen here are of the indigenous communities that have had a long struggle, have been marginalised for a long time, but actually are in a much stronger position now than they've been for a while. In many countries, that's not the position for indigenous communities. And either tourism is holding them back, or is trying to keep them in perspex, as a commodified version of what they should be, without allowing them to develop further. So a lot of these indigenous communities haven't had a chance to think about how do they develop and keep their culture. And then you throw tourism into the mix, and people are selling them the benefits of tourism, which are always oversold. And I think it's very difficult when you talk about free, prior and informed consent for people, even when you explain to communities what tourism could mean for them, it is very difficult for them to know exactly what the results of that tourism are going to be in the longer term. So on the whole, I think a lot of indigenous tourism is actually quite damaging to indigenous communities.
Thank you. My name's Emma Gregg. I'm a travel journalist. I've got a big interest in this topic. I'm particularly interested in the subject from a tourist perspective. What I'd like to know is, I'm often told by tourists that they like the idea of engaging with a community. They like the idea of visiting a community and learning about their life and their culture. But they feel really apprehensive about it because they want to be respectful and they just don't know how. They're really concerned that they might unwittingly make a mistake and they'd rather run away rather than put themselves into that position. So how do the projects that you're working on anticipate this and communicate with potential clients, customers, visitors, that it's okay and give them help as to how to fully embrace the experience positively and constructively for both sides?
Well,
that is a really excellent question, because I say that because the protocols for going into every tribe is different. If you go into the pueblos, you know, they don't like you to take pictures. So what we've done is we're creating how to make your best visit to Indian country positive. And so we do have the do's and don'ts that we offer as a guide for entering into Indian country. Another thing that I'm doing is I'm working with Brand USA to try to work with Brand USA and the National Park Service so that we can come up with a guidebook for the international visitors coming to national parks and Native American communities, because they're on or adjacent to, and provide that guidebook So you kind of have an idea that taking property from this area is not okay. It's not a souvenir. Or, you know, some of the etiquettes that visitors come to bring. And because he's absolutely right. We've seen communities get trashed by too many visitors in an area that doesn't have the infrastructure. And so by being actively involved at that level, that's where we IANTA sits. You know, our association is trying to do a lot of preventative measures. And so contacting us to get some of the do's and don'ts is one of the things.
I want to take just one last question and then come back to the panel for a final comment before we close.
So for you, Camille, just following up on what you last said, that a lot of Indigenous tourism is damaging when the Indigenous tribes are not strong and represented in how tourism is happening. So does that mean that right now, in your opinion, tour operators should stop offering Maasai experiences? Is there no Maasai alternative that's better, as we see with elephant riding? You know, don't ride the elephants, care for the elephants. Is there no, not that Maasai people are the same as elephants, but is there no better alternative in these types of countries?
With the Maasai, there's some quite good community-based tourism projects where you can get to stay in a Maasai village. Again, it's about the community running those and being involved in that and deciding the type of tourism that comes on. And the big thing for the Maasai is that their images are pushed all over the marketing blurb for Kenya to get tourists to come to Kenya, and yet their rights, they've been completely marginalised. They're kicked off their lands and actually marginalised within their own country. And that's been part of the problem, I think, is that there's this difference between sort of the image and the reality in many cases. But there are good places. The difficulty with all community-based tourism projects is they're small scale, they're community-based, they're by people without many resources. How do tourists find community-based tourism projects? How do they market themselves when they are very small scale, etc.? So, and it's how do tourists find out which is a genuine Maasai experience or a Disney-fied Maasai style experience that you can get as well? Because I mean, in some parts in Southern Africa, there's been a huge issue with Zulu tribes, etc., where you go there and actually none of them are actually from Xhosa or another tribe. They're not Zulus at all. They're just dressing up as Zulu. Now, is that wrong? I mean, you could go to Scotland tomorrow and go around Edinburgh Castle and there'd be an Australian there in a kilt and dressed up as a Scottish person, and that's part of what they're doing. We don't seem to mind that so much, but it is very more difficult, I think, in some of the other to find out what is a genuine experience and what is not.
Mark, we're just going to do the closing comments. So is there anything else you want to add from what you've said?
I just think kind of it's been about what the tourists expect. Again, there's Indigenous communities in Brazil that I visited, and when they're very much in control of the tourism, but then once a month the tourists come there and the kids get out of their normal clothes and put on their tourist clothes as they were. So they dress up for the tourists. But the tourists expect that. The tourists come back and I've heard tourists say, well, you know, I'm not sure it's a genuine experience because they've got telephones, because they've got satellite dishes, because they go. And I think we need to understand that Indigenous communities are not this. We're not going back in time. It's not a historical theme park we're going to. These are people's communities and lives, and they need to develop. And from a tourist point of view, we need to understand that and not expect people to be dressed up or doing dances that are inappropriate, etc.
Glyn O'Leary, who runs an African Ivory Route program, has a nice way of putting this. When tourists say it to him, well, you know, the Bushmen aren't properly dressed as Bushmen, he says, well, that's a real shame you didn't come 100 years ago. You'd have seen it like that then. Come here.
I think these. I would. We can talk all this. I really enjoy this subject.
Well, we're going to do it again next year.
Okay. For instance, I was at ITB and I was in my regalia because we were showcasing the different cultures, right? The next day I didn't wear my regalia and the photographer told me, well, I don't want to take your picture, you don't look native enough. Well, that's kind of what he's saying. But something that I think is so important to keep in mind when you come to America, there are 573 sovereign tribes. They have sovereignty. So they address how they do business differently within their own cultures. So that's why tourism is in different levels and different situations where the research is going to be really important. What level of tourism are they at? And that's where the NativeAmerica.travel comes into play. And where our association, which we're really fortunate that there is an association that is supporting Native American tourism that protects the traditions and values. And that's not the case for every country. And that's where I think this networking right now is going to help build that so that we can support each other so that there is a sustainable cultural experience that all of you in the world can experience, because it is a way of life. It's a traditional way of life. It's how we live today. And it may be that we have cell phones today.
Cameron, any closing thoughts?
Three very brief thoughts. First of all, I couldn't agree with you more. So what she said. Second comment is, I couldn't agree more with your comment about the need to have another session like this next year. Not just a rerun of this discussion, but something that takes it forward. Because it really is such an important agenda. And thirdly, just I suppose to coherently answer the question that you asked me earlier about how come a boy from Orkney is standing in the Arctic smuggling fish from community to community. It's because I think there's a real role for intermediaries in this to help communities engage effectively with the tourism industry and vice versa. And I can sort of do that. That's why I'm doing it.
But why can you do it?
Skill, talent, natural charm and determination.
And coming from Orkney?
Yes.
Can I just thank you all? It's amazing you stayed so late. So thank you very much. If you could just thank the panel, I'd be grateful.
Guys.